I'm a young English teacher. It's my second year in an inner city school in London, and I think I'm doing well with my tutor group, a class of 11-year-olds. My only problem is Tom. That's not his real name, but I'm going to call him Tom. He scribbles all over my worksheet and starts to chew on it, preparing to spit little wads of damp paper across the room. I have to do something. The memory of the rioting classes during my probation is the phantom that informs so much of my teaching now. The missiles flying across the room, the furniture being pushed out of it, the shouting, the swearing, and the fighting. No, if I let Tom continue to misbehave, there will be chaos. I crouch down beside him and hiss in a low whisper, "Get on with your work." He is a thin, undernourished boy, his mouth always set in an angry sneer. "No," he says, "I won't." He scrunches up the remainder of the soggy worksheet, throwing it in my face. The class stop writing their story and wait to see who will win. I stride to the door, fling it open and point at the corridor. Reluctantly, kicking over his chair, Tom slopes out, shouting at me, "Your mum! Your mum! Your mum!" It's the familiar cuss of the school. Okay, fast forward a few months. Tom has been disciplined, but is still a problem. I feel it would be good for him to come on a trip to a rural study centre with the rest of the class, and my head of year agrees. But we are worried. There's an argument with some of the other teachers about this. They say he should definitely stay in school because he could be a danger to himself and others. Finally, it's agreed that he can come along. After a noisy, stressful journey on the train, the class spends the week in the countryside, trekking, making fires, bird watching, cooking their own meals and tidying up after themselves. All the children love it, but the change in Tom is astonishing. On the second night there, I watch him leap along the mountainside and realise that this is the first time I've ever seen him laugh. He takes a keen interest in bird watching, enjoys making food on the campfire and foraging for berries. Even more amazingly, he begins to get on with his classmates. Observing his transformation was a revelation. I've never forgotten the visceral lesson it taught me. When put in the right environment, even so-called unteachable students can be transformed into learners. But I've got to be honest with you, it's not a lesson I've fully absorbed until recently. I continued teaching for the next 10 years and became obsessed with keeping discipline in my classes and drilling my pupils to pass exams. I was very contemptuous of child-centred approaches to education. Perhaps this explains why I hated Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Émile or On Education when I first read it in the late 1990s. This strange philosophical novel, written in the mid-18th century, describes how the author would educate an imaginary student, Émile. Rousseau sets out his idealistic principles, and I didn't like the sound of them. I felt insulted to read that, according to Rousseau, no child should be punished, and that the only rule for them should be to harm no one. Rousseau's contempt for traditional methods of schooling felt like a punch in the face to me. Where he saw little point in trapping young children in classrooms and forcing them to read and write against the will, this was the whole point for me. His idealistic visions of Émile, learning through games devised for him by his tutor in natural settings, felt fake and unconvincing. It just seemed totally impractical for a child to learn how to count in the fields, to learn geometry from observing the sun, and that the only book students should read was Robinson Crusoe because it would teach them how to live on a desert island. And then the blatant sexism of the last section confirmed my disdain. Here, Rousseau describes the ideal education of a fictional girl, Sophie. Because girls are naturally weaker than boys and will become mothers, they need a very different education, he says. They need to learn to serve men, tend to their needs and be submissive. Total rot. Or so I thought. My opinions about Rousseau's educational philosophy gradually changed over time, although I continued to be exasperated by the chronic sexism of Émile. but I began to see that Rousseau may have been making some valid points in other regards when I observed my young son grow up in the mid-noughties. I was now a head of department in a large comprehensive in outer London and moonlighting as a polemical author on educational topics. I published I'm a Teacher, Get Me Out of Here in 2004 and was regularly asked by the media to give my views on all sorts of educational topics. The right-wing press loved me because I tended to espouse my views about the importance of discipline and authority. And yet things were happening in my personal life which were making me change my views. My wife and I initially sent our son, Theo, to a private prep school because we felt we didn't want him to experience the indiscipline that I believed occurred in many state schools. A few things happened to change my views. Because I found managing a department and being a parent too much, I went part-time and began picking up my six-year-old, Theo, from the prep school. Seeing his education close up made me realise he was unhappy. He was being lectured at, told to do tests in silence, do burdensome, pointless homework, and his natural instincts to be creative, verbal and active were being crushed. So we moved him out of the school and put him in our local inner-city primary school, which did not set homework, let the children play quite a bit, had no uniform and focused upon educating the whole child. He absolutely flourished. But why? Well, I think Rousseau has some answers here. In book 2 of Emile, Rousseau writes of the young learner, "Instead of being allowed to stagnate in the stale air of a room, let him be taken to the middle of a field. There let him run and frisk about." I had the very same instinct when it came to my son. He needed to be running about, playing, and not wasting his time doing lots of mock tests in silence. He needed to learn to be happy. And this is what his brilliant inner city school did. What is more, because he was happy, he did much better in the formal tests he had. He wrote stories he wanted to write. He read what he wanted to read. He articulated thoughts and feelings freely both in and out of school. The school took a Rousseau approach to education, in the sense that at the heart of its philosophy was the belief that children's natural instincts for learning should be carefully nurtured. With a dawning sense of self-recrimination and guilt, I began to realise that many of my firmly held beliefs about education were built on very flimsy foundations. I returned to Rousseau's ideas and to those of his followers, Maria Montessori, John Dewey and Paulo Freire. These were thinkers who I used to scorn because of their insistence that we had to listen to children and help them actively learn concepts rather than insist upon adults telling them what to do. This re-evaluation changed me as a person and a teacher. I wanted my child to play and enjoy his life, and I wanted my students to learn through playful activities. I valued putting joy at the heart of my pedagogy. Up until then, I'd generally been praised by the powers that be in education, Ofsted senior teachers and advisors, for my firm but fair approach in the classroom. But I began to encounter resistance when my teaching became more creative. For example, a few years ago, I used some of Rousseau's precepts to teach my Year 10 students, 14-year-olds, poetry. It was a tricky class. I had a girl, Sally, not her real name, who was noisy, rude and disruptive, rather like Tom had been, and a significant rump of disaffected boys who hated poetry. I decided to use clapping to get them into the idea that language is basically about rhythm. My class sat in a circle and said a few simple phrases to each other like, "How are you?" and then clapped their rhythm. Using this natural method, they quickly began to see there are stressed and unstressed beats in all the words we say. I asked them to compose their own conversation poems with clapping accompaniment and then progressed to getting them to clap some easy poems which I knew they would like. Finally, I asked them to perform some more complex poems, the work of Wilfred Owen, to their own natural accompaniments. They clapped, they stamped their feet, popped and clicked using their mouths, and sang. It was a very beautiful September, and feeling courageous, I asked my pupils to find places around the school where they could drum and practice their poems, ready for performance. I videoed them in their various nooks. They all sought out natural places in the school, sitting by bushes, by trees, and by the grassy bank of a school pond. Sally loved it. She laughed, joked around, and drummed the poems enthusiastically. Unfortunately, a senior manager learnt what I was doing, and I got reprimanded, hauled in front of the head teacher, who expressed his stern disapproval. Rousseau's ideas informed what I was doing. My aim was to make learning playful using the resources of the human body. Above all, my purpose in educating my students was not primarily cognitive. I was not interested in the facts. I simply wanted them to learn to love poetry and to learn to work together. My purposes were aesthetic and moral. The last two sections of Emile focus on how the teenager can be appropriately socialised and how he can learn to love his fellow human beings in a reasoned fashion. Rousseau felt that it wasn't until children reached puberty that they were truly ready to work with others. The collaborative exercises which I devised aimed to develop my students' powers of reason and collaboration in careful stages, moving from individual activities to collaborative ones. Sally, in particular, benefited from this approach. If Rousseau were alive today, he would despair of the senior managers who stopped my students drumming. He would have called the head teacher an agent of slavery, in that he represented a corrupt institution which stifled children's natural instincts. Rousseau wouldn't blame the head teacher. He would blame the social structures which had corrupted his thinking, the central government edicts, Ofsted, the obsession with exam results, the aim of using education to increase economic wealth. For Rousseau, we have been made servile, cogs in a gigantic machine which grinds remorselessly on with no regard for our natural lives. Rousseau condemns the structures of society. He says, "All our wisdom consists in servile prejudices. All our practices are only subjection, impediment, and constraint. Civil man is born, lives, and dies in slavery." While I disagree with Rousseau on many things, his views on women, his belief that children can't be reasoned with until they are in their teens, his dismissal of every book except Robinson Crusoe, I think his central message is still important. Our lifestyles have taken us further and further away from natural ways of living. Let's put a renewed emphasis upon appreciating the natural things of life. The air we breathe, the food we eat, the movement of our bodies, and the way we communicate with ourselves and others. Let's set aside our obsession with screens, computers, property, work, money, and material consumption. Let's look at each other and smile, listen to the birds singing, and take pleasure in the food we eat. Let's live our lives again, and teach our children to do the same. Even if we did this just for a few minutes every day, I believe it would make a difference to our lives and our children's lives. As Rousseau says, man turns everything upside down. He disfigures everything. He wants nothing as nature made it, not even man. For him, man must be trained like a school horse. Perhaps it is time to stop treating our children like horses, take off their blinkers, and open the stable doors.